So after taking over 50 episodes to get, what, 8 years covered, we're suddenly flying through the 80s and the 70s in like 3 episodes. And The Search for Spock is a very 80s movie.
Oh, yeah. And it's especially hilarious because it's a direct sequel to In the Matter of Days to Khan. And the hairstyles have changed. The production styles have changed. So it's, you know,
everybody is suddenly wearing leather jackets.
Yeah.
Uhura had some nice shoulder pads.
And that her hair. I loved her hair.
The Jerry curl.
Yeah.
It's strange because it's not something that we have really, I think, commented on before. But we're going through a lot of time now. And it's weird. Yeah. And this movie, you know, it's just in a, on a production level, it's a very much an 80s movie.
Yeah.
And not even in terms of the costuming, but in terms of the way it's shot and the way it's lit, you know, a lot of the special effects have not aged super well. And it is, we'll say this up front, I don't think it's as good a movie as Wrath of Khan, but what is?
Yes, that is a lot of it. Wrath of Khan, I get the sense that there will not be another Star Trek movie that's as good as that one.
I would disagree with that, actually.
Okay.
I mean, I said last week that I like The Voyage Home more than Wrath of Khan. Is it a better movie than The Wrath of Khan? Probably not.
Well, those are two different things. I mean, considered as, you know, tick off what makes a fine film. Wrath of Khan will hit more of those than probably Voyage Home will, but Voyage Home might be just more fun to watch.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And The Search for Spock is a good movie. I mean, I think it has an unfair reputation, you know, but since I know a lot about it and this is your first time seeing it, what did you think about it?
Well, I knew nothing going in other than, I mean, I read the Roger Ebert review and he specifically says, what, do you think they're not going to find him? And that's pretty much, I knew that there was some weird kind of Vulcan mysticism which got him alive in the end. That's about all I knew going into the movie. I would say the parts that are good are excellent in the movie. It's got some really good quotable lines. Like, I think as far as catchiness, it's a good script. While I think the movie never gets bad, it's not as consistent as Wrath of Khan. In other words, I may like the scene, like Uhura's big scene, better than anything in Wrath of Khan, but it's a little too more peaks and valleys. Wrath of Khan is very good all the way through.
The Search for Spock is more of a fan's movie than The Wrath of Khan, mm-hmm. I would say. And it really relies on having some sort of knowledge and affection of these people more than anything else.
Well, yeah, the entire thing is to revive a character who doesn't appear till the last 5 minutes of the movie, really.
Which is really strange because they tried to create a sense of mystery about whether or not Leonard Nimoy was in the movie. I don't know if you noticed, but he wasn't in the opening credits, for example. Okay. And he doesn't appear until the last, basically, 10 or 15 minutes.
Other than, like, flashback stock footage at the beginning.
Right, at the beginning of the movie. But at the same time, like you said, no one's really going to think that they don't find him, right?
Yeah.
There's a great, I think, a quote from I think William Shatner, who said something like, "Yeah, I wasn't going to turn to the camera at the end of the movie and go, sorry, I wouldn't find him, folks. Movie's over." Like, that's,
I mean,
not
it would be
happen.
A twist, but yeah, that's the, I think it was in Ebert's review where he said it's essentially just a vehicle to get Spock back, and really at the end of the day, that's what happens in the movie.
It's really a chase movie.
Yeah,
it's a chase movie and it's a heist movie.
And I have to say, the Klingon plot is the main conflict in that, because without the Klingon plot, there would be no major complications. They'd steal the ship. They have no major problems stealing the ship and all of that. And climax scene, you know, David wouldn't have died. They wouldn't have had to have this last minute, you know, the planet's crumbling as we're getting, you know, all of that wouldn't happen. So in a way, the Klingon plot is kind of a manufactured conflict.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And since you bring it up,
I know you don't like it.
Yeah, yeah, I'm not a fan of Christopher Lloyd as a Klingon. He's a great actor, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But one of my primary problems with the movie is he's too big of a character actor to ever blend into the background of the movie in the way that a character like that should. And I'm not saying that to say that the villain of a movie should be bland or shouldn't be interesting, but he's not a Klingon who's played by Christopher Lloyd. He's Christopher Lloyd playing a Klingon.
I can see that.
And it just doesn't work. I don't think.
That makes sense.
He's too manic. He's his eyes are bugging. It's just got that voice. And, you know, he doesn't come across as, I don't even think, a believable Klingon, whatever that means. But maybe that's just me being a Trekkie. But
yeah.
And two, I think the Klingons are strange in this movie because this is really the most we've seen Klingons since the original series. And I don't want to get into a huge discussion about, you know, Klingons and stuff, because we'll be talking a lot about Klingons when we get to the next generation. But some of the stuff in this movie was very influential in later Star Treks. You know, Kapla is a thing later on. And
what is that?
That's what the thing they said in Klingon, which was basically like, Kapla means success. So they kept saying Kapla, Kapla, Kapla.
Okay, you have to understand. When I see people in a movie talking in any other language, it gets filtered as blah, 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 literally to me. So, like, the entire – that whole beginning scene, by the way, where there's the Klingon woman, and I don't have no idea what the hell happened during that scene. I couldn't figure it out because it's unsubtitled Klingon and a ship was destroyed.
There were subtitles.
Not when I watched it.
Well, that's a problem then.
There wasn't a single subtitle in
– That's really bad.
Oh, God.
They're supposed to be subtitles.
Okay. Well, okay. So, wow. See, I was surprised at the movie for giving us all these unsubtitled scenes, but I guess that...
Okay, folks. So if you watched this movie on Netflix, as Richard did, and there are no subtitles, then you should probably track down a DVD copy of it.
Or see if the subtitles get, you know, turn them on or something like that. Oh, wow. Okay. So what the hell happened in that beginning scene?
Well, briefly, you know, it's not really spelled out, but...
I mean, I got like, yeah.
Basically what happens is she is his wife or lover, Commander Kruge, yeah. She is tracking down the Genesis information because the Klingon knows about it and wants it because he wants it as a weapon. Yeah. Makes sense. He's a Klingon. Okay.
Yeah. It turns out, it does have wonderful destructive potential.
Sure. She transfers the information over to the Klingon ship and then she lets it slip that she has seen the information. And he says, that's unfortunate. She says, I understand. And then they fire on the ship.
Okay.
Because he doesn't want anybody to know what the Genesis device can do. It's really unfortunate, actually, that was unsubtitled, because there's quite a lot of Klingon in this movie, and...
Yeah, like, I got a lot of the, in general, what was going on, or it was... For the most part, the unsubtitled Klingon didn't really bother me, because it was, you know, him barking orders at his crew, and, you know, then they're doing some kind of space thing, so I just assume, all right, it's something like that. I thought during the whole movie they would explain a little more of what happened during that first scene. Like, it would be clearer who that was, but it just seemed a plot thread that was never resolved. But then if it was subtitled in the beginning, that would have been explained right then and there. Okay.
Yeah. And that brings up another interesting point. I think one of the other major problems with the movie is that it does have plot strands which are just dropped.
Yeah.
Right? So you have the ship at the beginning, which is dropped and never mentioned again, which is destroyed. Mm. You have the character, the woman character really doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I don't understand why she had to be connected with Commander Kruge in any way.
Unless it's just to show that he's that brutal and that, you know.
Yeah, it could be. But then again, he doesn't really ever... That's the other problem I have with Christopher Lloyd's portrayal of a Klingon, is just it comes across as a little too cartoony.
Mm.
And maybe this is just my own personal, you know, prejudices as well, because I know Christopher Lloyd the best from Back to the Future and, you know, watching that movie when I was 5 years old. So Adam's Family, not so much. Okay. But the other thing is that, you know, the Klingons destroy the Grissom, and that is never really brought up again. There's this weird plot about the Genesis device becoming a galactic controversy, which doesn't really ever go anywhere. So there's a lot of stuff that doesn't really get resolved in any way. And I don't know that the movie is necessarily interested in telling the story that it's telling.
Okay. See, okay. So I felt that this was one of those things that brought up a lot more questions than it answered. So let's can we specifically talk about that point that the Genesis device is the secret, or that it's a forbidden topic. The second that they get into the Federation thing, that the other admiral, the black one, what's his name?
I'm not sure what his name is, okay. but
anyway,
yeah.
You know, he says, you know, I'm sorry, but you know, Genesis's planet is considered a controversial subject. That wasn't how they intended to test it. Given that the Klingons seem to be very interested in that, I don't blame the Federation for wanting to keep it under wraps until they can secure it a little better. Given what eventually happens to the planet, I don't necessarily begrudge them the fact that they wanted to do this all very by the book and very safely. Like, that actually is very good on the Federation. The only thing, if Spock's body had not been on the Genesis planet, there would be no reason to go there until it had been totally scanned and totally fixed. And, you know, by that point, you know, assuming there's no Klingon, by that point, they would have realized, oh, there's something wrong with this planet. You know, we need to not get on it. You know, they made it out of proto matter or whatever. Like, all of those things, okay. At the same time, they're letting a non-Federation scientist, yes, the one who developed it, but a non-Federation scientist, a woman who has...
Well, he's not a non-Federation scientist. He's a non-Starfleet scientist.
Okay, sorry. Savik is fairly new. How is she getting the clearance to explore this planet? Like, these are questions that I have from that. Who's deciding... That who is the Federation top brass? We never see them. Who is running Starfleet and the Federation? Because it implies a group that is in charge that has made these decisions for everyone. It implies people that are over Kirk's head.
Well, they do mention a Federation Council in this movie. That, I think that's the first time that the Federation Council is ever mentioned. There's supposed to be a Joint Chiefs. I mean, there is a command structure in place, and this is a civilian governed military agency or whatever you want to call it. So, I'm not. Why do you have an issue with that?
It's not less an issue. It's less an issue. It's more just I'm curious. The movies have been fleshing out the world nicely, and by this point, the universe is a lot more fleshed out. We do get a sense of. There are actually, it's not directly on Earth, but it's on this starbase for the most part. But we get a sense of what daily life on this starbase is. We have scenes in the bar. We have scenes in, you know, their apartment. We see a jail.
They are supposed to be on Earth. I mean, that isn't Shatner. That is Kirk's apartment from Wrath of Khan.
Okay, yeah, I know they docked into this big structure that's orbiting Earth, so I wasn't sure if it was on the planet itself or in that space station. It didn't really matter necessarily in either case. But either way, we see a bit more of what daily life is for just average people, for just the support people. And I like that. At the same time, revealing more of the world lets us realize that there are parts that haven't been revealed still.
Yeah. It's interesting because Roddenberry was not heavily involved in the rest of the movies, and I think there's a level of verisimilitude in these movies that Roddenberry just was not interested in providing.
Yeah,
so I like that. There's a reference for the source material that I think is really important. You know, my problem with it is more that. Not that some of these things in the society are perhaps not as thought out as you would like them to be, but that the setup for the movie doesn't exactly jive with the end of Wrath of Khan. And since it is a direct sequel, I think it needs to there, because at the end of Wrath of Khan, as we said, there's a level of hope there. There's a level of, okay, rebirth. You know, Kirk is saying he feels young again.
Yeah.
Carol Marcus is there. David is there. Savik is there. And then at the beginning of Search for Spock, Savik and David are on this other ship.
Yeah.
Where did they, you know, how did they get there? What happened there?
The actress who played Dr. Marcus died, right?
No.
I thought that she did.
No, she's alive. Okay. David, the actor who played David, died.
Oh, that made me.
Yeah,
was...
and it was actually pretty tragic. He had AIDS.
Oh, God.
And he died, I think, in 1988 or 89.
Mm. Okay.
He was not looking great in this movie, if you noticed.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, it's a shame. Because I always liked the character of David, and I think he probably could have been, if they had not killed him in this movie, you know, interesting to see again, but just didn't happen. So Carol Marcus is not in this movie at all. You know, where did she go?
Yeah, I mean, it's unclear how much time has passed and where they went. Because then did Savick and David just meet the Grissom was met them en route? Like, I got the sense that it would make sense if they all went home and then from there departed onto their separate ways.
I think, you know, plot wise, it doesn't make a ton of sense. But what I find more interesting is that tonally, it doesn't make a lot of sense, because, again, the end of The Wrath of Khan is very hopeful, and the beginning of Search for Spock is very much not.
At the same time, even though they're sequels, one does have to consider them separate movies, and it's harder to start from a place of hope and have a movie about striving for an impossible goal. So yeah, it makes sense to have it beginning in a lower sense, a lower spirit. And frankly, it's been a couple weeks after Spock's death, and it's finally just hit him. Kirk's had a lot of things to distract him with at the end of Wrath of Khan. He's had people in sickbay to visit. He's had ship's repairs to supervise and to deal with. He's had the new course to plot. He's been in touch with Starfleet and figuring out where all these crew are dealing with. So he's been busy.
Yeah.
At this point now, I mean, he's explicitly saying at the beginning, you know, this feels like a house that, you know, all the kids have left. You know, all of the trainees have gone on to different spots. You know, Savick and David, who are two people that Kirk would very much like to be around, who could comfort him very effectively and probably have been. They're gone. So yeah, he is. I think this is just it's a few weeks later and it's starting to click.
That could be.
At the very beginning, by the way, this is just his shirt's kind of undone, and it's just in the first scene. Did you notice that?
Yeah, that's a thing that they do sometimes. It's, okay. You know, just, hey, I'm a little more casual right now.
I was curious about that because it just went completely unremarked. I haven't really seen that before.
I think that brings up something interesting, because one of my other problems with the movie is the Savick and David scenes on the planet. And I think the movie has some structural issues, as we've already mentioned. Yeah. And I think this is another one of them. There are too many of the scenes. Mm-hmm. They don't really lend much to the movie. You know, they're not very economical. Like, you could have one or two of them, and we have, you know, many of them. And it has to do, I think, with a couple of things. You know, Leonard Nimoy's direction, while it's certainly fine, he's no Nicholas Meyer.
Yeah.
It's very pedestrian. It does the job, but I don't find it to be all that interesting.
Had he directed much by this point?
I don't know.
So this might have been his first or second directorial thing.
I mean, I would assume that he had directed some things before, because you don't give a big summer blockbuster to someone who has never directed one before. But, you know, who knows? The cinematography in the movie I don't find is all that interesting. A lot of the lighting is too harsh. The Genesis planet especially doesn't come across very well, because it's no location shooting at all. It's all a soundstage, and it just looks cheap. And I think that's a problem with the movie in general, is that the movie looks cheap. You know, the Commander Kruge has this puppet dog, which is frankly ridiculous.
I liked it.
It's the scenes of the Grissom Bridge, the actor playing the captain.
Well, that's at the captain's discretion, and that's me. Yeah.
It's kind of a whoever was doing the casting for this movie perhaps was not as good as the person doing the casting for Wrath of Khan. And I don't think that Leonard Nimoy is as good at getting good performances out of actors as Meyer was, especially Shatner, who is nowhere near as good an actor in this movie. He does not give nearly as good a performance as he did in Wrath of Khan.
I have to say, well, those Klingon bastards killed my son. That could have been a now to hear him say the word bastard in it's, which is a word we have never heard in Star Trek, well, is shocking in its way. And yet it's a much bigger scene than, you know, Spock's death, which he's basically barely, you know, where he's just choking out and mumbling and whispering at the funeral is just, you know, again, Kirk is always at 11, so to see him at 2, it shows how broken he is. When his son died, he's back up. It feels a little less effective.
No, I would agree with you, and that's a performance issue, really. Yeah. You know, I just don't think that, for whatever reason, Shatner was not there, really, for this movie in a lot of it. And
I get the sense that Shatner's somebody who needs to be taken down, needs to be restrained, and the way to get a great performance out of Shatner is to pull him back.
Well, actually, it was funny you mentioned that, because I was doing some background research into this, and something Nicholas Meyer said about directing Shatner in Wrath of Khan was he shot the scenes so much until Shatner got bored with them, and then acting would come out.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah. Nimoy, whether it was due to, you know, technique, whether it was due to talent, whether it was due to the fact that maybe he didn't feel... I can see directing Shatner being a very difficult thing to do. You need... He's the kind of actor you would need, especially at this time, a very specific hand with that Nimoy just didn't seem to have. So he took the first take or two, probably.
Yeah. Let's talk about Savick in this movie.
Okay, we're done talking about Savick in this. I don't really have much to say about her. I mean,
I honestly wish that the character of Savick was only in The Wrath of Khan and never came back again, because actress that they got to replace Kirstie Alley is...
Not Kirstie Alley.
Is fine, but yeah, not Kirstie Alley. And she comes across, like, Kirstie Alley's Savick is, it seems kind of impish, kind of knowing. She's very intelligent. She seems very competent, but she has this edge about her.
And again, what I liked about her performance is that she is very Vulcan, but she's a Vulcan who recognizes her emotions and is beginning to learn how to channel and use them in very proper ways. I don't get that sense here.
Well, the problem with Savick in this movie is that it doesn't feel like the same character.
Yeah.
It feels like a completely different character. And you know, I think that's another reason why the Genesis Planet sequences just feel very flat and very unimportant, because, you know, that scene where they find that the coffin is empty should have been a very, very big moment.
Yeah.
And it doesn't come across as it. And I think a large portion of that is because of Savick.
Hmm.
You know, David is David, and he's shiny and kind of sweaty and seems a little unwell. But Savick is really falling down on the job here. And it's a problem with those portions of the movie, because I think where Wrath of Khan was really up there and really in your face about these sort of things, The Search for Spock is I think more of a mannered movie, and it's more at a distance, and it feels kind of like you're watching it through glass. Do you know what I mean?
You know, I'm thinking about on long similar lines. It feels like this is taking, you know, Vulcans are logical to mean Vulcans have very muted personalities. Spock, you will never say that Spock has no personality. You can't say that Khan's Savick has no personality. Even Sarek seems a little less himself in this. And Sarek has always had a strong personality in the times we've seen him. So that she seems a lot less, there's a lot less to her. She is a very, she doesn't really have much of a character in this beyond logic, beyond, you know, emotionlessness. I think it's confusing emotionlessness for a lack of personality.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Savick neither has no personality nor no emotions.
Yeah, yeah. let's talk about since we're talking about emotions and Vulcans, let's start getting into some of the McCoy stuff and the Katra and everything. Because
so when you talk about inconsistent, I really, is McCoy possessed? Is he going crazy? Is he half human, half Vulcan, half human now? Is he? The movie does not seem to know what exactly Spock putting his Katra into McCoy means, other than it's a ticket that he can take at the end of, you know, to the end of the movie to, you know, get Leonard Nimoy an acting career again.
I'm surprised that you had a problem with it, to be honest.
Really?
Yeah, because it is what it is. And
no, but the thing
is, it completely makes sense to me.
But the thing is, they could have done it so much better. So, okay.
Well, let's get into something first. So last week I said that something happened in The Wrath of Khan which you did not notice. And you're still apparently at a loss for what I'm talking about looking at your face.
Is this the remember bit?
Yeah.
Oh, I noticed that happening. Yeah, that was very obvious that happened. So here's the thing. So, okay.
You had a huge fit when in Requiem for Methuselah, Spock at the end of that episode went to Kirk and said forget.
Yeah.
And what I'm laying down is you are completely not picking up on the opposite part of that, which is Spock apparently now has the other ability to transfer his consciousness into someone else.
Yeah.
Through the use of you know, Vulcan voodoo.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I don't know that there's much there, but I just find it interesting that you haven't mentioned it.
Yeah. See, well, let me put it this way. I don't understand the rules behind the Katra. So here's the thing. Spock touches McCoy, and the remember scene, he's transferring his Katra. During the rest of the movie, we see him acting like him. During the rest of the movie, the last few minutes of it, during the scene where he's talking to Kirk, he is still very much himself. He is speaking as Spock has always spoken, those scenes, the needs of the many, you know, I'm always your friend, live long, okay. It is still Spock at that point. Does Spock have a Katra, and did he copy his Katra into McCoy?
You're asking me?
Yes.
I don't know.
Okay, so that's the first thing. So then, okay, we see, because when they have Spock's body, it's there. We're told it's an empty shell and autonomic reflexes versus, you know, stuff that you need an actual brain to control. We'll get into later, but because the implication is that he had gotten rid of this Katra and put it into McCoy, kind of as a, using McCoy as a hard drive for himself, and then they upload it back into Spock. Okay, fine, except it seems more like a copy. When we first see McCoy in Spock's room, which is a very wonderful scene. I loved that. He is talking as Spock. He is essentially possessed by Spock. And so I'm thinking for the rest of the movie, okay, so he's going to be half McCoy, half Spock. At some point, he's going to be more one than the other. He's going to be maybe a merge of the two personalities. But they can't figure out what exactly having Spock's Katra in McCoy means for McCoy. They can't tell. And for a while they're saying, well, this McCoy's acting disturbed and crazy, but, and then once he's on the ship, you know, the Enterprise, and for the rest of the movie, he's pretty fine. All of the Spock parts seem to kind of downplay, other than McCoy's a little better at some science stuff than he had been. For the rest part, especially when they're on the planet, you know, when they're seeing the Enterprise, you know, go down, you know, McCoy is talking as McCoy.
I guess my question for you would be, why does it matter? And why are you so focused on it?
Because when you have, because magic requires rules in order to aid the suspension of disbelief. Otherwise, I didn't feel that enough rules were made around the Katra to make it believable. And as such, it just kind of seems like, well, we needed some way of getting Spock back. Let's just get some mystical Vulcan hoodoo and hope the audience doesn't question it too much.
Yeah.
That's how it came off. If there had been a bit more consistency to it, if it felt like they had thought it out better, because I don't think they felt, I don't think they, it, the questions that I've brought up, the movie doesn't seem to supply answers to those.
Well, here's, okay. So I think there's two ways that you can go about talking about this. I think number one is that it just as the movie has plot threads that it drops, I think in a similar way, it drops a lot of the questions about the Katra and how exactly it works. And this is just a structural problem with this movie.
Yeah. And I agree with that. It's, I can accept, you know, the way that the Genesis device works makes no goddamn sense, but I, you know, proto matter is not a thing. That doesn't really, I don't understand why that's bad, but it's established well enough in the movie that this is just half-assed science and it's unstable. And that's enough. So
you're okay with half-assed science as a non-Trekkie, but you're not okay with half-assed mysticism?
Just, it's half-assed but consistent, I would say. Nothing in the way the Genesis device is presented seems to contradict itself. The way the Katra is presented, the way the Katra's effects on McCoy are presented, those seem to contradict themselves.
Here's how I respond to that. I think that technobabble being and fake science being consistent makes sense because science is consistent. It's based on natural laws. It's based on physical things that are observable and happen all the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that the Katra being unpredictable is much more to do with the fact that mysticism and religion and spirituality are not predictable, right? And you can accept that answer or you can't, but I think that's the answer that the movie provides us with.
See,
and
I can't because number one, this is a Vulcan soul. And if any mysticism is going to have rules, and there are schools of mysticism which have rules.
McCoy's not a Vulcan, though. You're forgetting that important point.
There is that. Yes. Okay. Fair point.
And so the very end of the movie when they're talking about the ritual and they're talking about you know, Sarek is asking for the Fator Pan and, you know, the joining of the Katra, uh-huh, with the body, and, you know, he's saying that this has not happened. The woman is saying that this has not happened in thousands of years. No one can remember the last time it happened.
Yeah, and it was a legend. No one's sure if that's true. And even so, that was two Vulcans who were dealing with this. Yeah.
Right. And so I think, number one, you have to look at that important point, right? That McCoy is not a Vulcan. McCoy was not prepared for this. You know, whatever you want to say about humans in the Star Trek mythos, we've never seen any evidence that they have any sort of special mental powers. There's no telekinesis, there's no telepathy involved in humans in this universe, right?
We've seen a couple examples, but they're usually fairly episode contained, like Where No Man Has Gone Before deals with psychic powers, but that's explained in the episode. Fair enough. It's not like people are just, you know, people being born with telepathy is a regular occurrence.
Right, exactly. And so humans don't have the mental discipline to really understand what's happening to them or that the Katra is there, right? My interpretation of the Katra has always been that it is it's some sort of combination of soul and consciousness, right? And so it is what makes the Vulcan the Vulcan. And McCoy having Spock's Katra means that Spock transferred his essence and his knowledge. And, you know, because Sarek says in that scene, and we'll talk about that scene, I mean, you know, where he basically says, look, you know, all of his knowledge, all that what Spock knew, all that he had is lost now, where, you know, what happened. I always get the impression that it's more of a sort of a download, and, you know, maybe the Katra is in McCoy and Spock is still able to function without it, but he doesn't have a lot of the knowledge that he used to have, and he doesn't have sort of the soul anymore. It is a little hand wavy, but that's kind of what you have to go with.
One also has to wonder if, you know, it's expected that there is a ritual that the soul is kind of released into. And I wonder if, you know, I assume that going on these steps and performing this ritual is kind of the equivalent of sending a Vulcan to heaven. Maybe there is some kind of way the Vulcans that can commune with these souls. Do you think that might be a thing? Is that a thing?
I mean, sure, that could be.
Especially considering that, you know, he's saying, you know, all that Spock knew, all that he was, all, you know, is lost. having Spock's soul, if there is a way of accessing that kind of ancestral memory, would be an asset to Vulcan, you know, and they would want him, you know, Spock, number one, out of dignity for his, you know, soul, you know, deserves to have proper rest. But,
yeah,
it, you know, he also considers it a loss to the universe.
And I think to take this a little bit further and to take it perhaps a little more meta, this is just how Star Trek operates.
Yeah.
And I think you're finding that that's what you don't like about Star Trek.
Yeah. I mean,
and that's what I like about it. I think if you can't accept that Star Trek is going to always go for perfunctory explanations that give us big emotional payoffs more than it's going to go for being some sort of intellectual science fiction, you know, enterprise.
Yeah.
You're not going to really get Star Trek.
Okay, and I can that's fair.
And so what is important with the Katra and the entire experience of the search for Spock is not how the Katra works, yeah, in the same way that it's not important how warp drive works. What's important is the stories that it enables them to tell and the emotions that it enables them to engender in the audience.
And that's fair. Again, there does need to be some way that Spock gets back, and, you know, mystical Vulcan hoodoo is just as good as any, you know, and that is a fair point. I just thought it could have been a little more polished.
And that's fair.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not arguing that the search for Spock is a super polished, yeah, piece of filmmaking.
Oh yeah. It's not a fantastic movie. It's an inconsistent movie. It could have been a better movie. And I think at the end of the day, my feeling is that it should have been a better movie. That said, it is interesting that it's McCoy who has the Katra in this.
Well, I was about to say, I mean, you know, say what you will about the Katra and what you think of it, but come on, it's just goddamn fun to watch McCoy deal with this.
Yeah, and when he figures it out, like, he doesn't even say, like, this is his revenge for losing all those arguments, you know? He thinks that this is a hilarious Vulcan prank that's been played on him, which is total McCoy. Yeah. Given McCoy and Spock's relationship, again, at the end, you know, he's explicitly told this is a big risk, you know, to you. They could have just as easily just dispelled this soul and, you know, moved on. But McCoy basically says, look, you know, yeah, why stop now? You know, this is, of course, I'll take it on, you know, great time to ask, you know.
Yeah, he's basically like, I choose the danger, right,
yeah,
at the end of the movie, which is just great.
Another
and
great
I think
quote.
And that's the other thing about Star Trek, right? And I think why the search for Spock is perhaps, you know, has a lesser reputation than it deserves is that it's a fun movie, and I think, you know, all of the characters are going into it with their eyes wide open and they know exactly what they're getting into, even if they don't completely understand all the implications of it.
Yeah, the movie is largely about loyalty. Loyalty is trumps kind of anything. The scene when they finally take over the Enterprise and they're about to go, you know, Kirk says, you know, look, you know, McCoy and I have to do this. You know, I'm doing this because I'm Kirk and he's Spock. You know, McCoy has this soul in him, but you could probably go and, you know, talk your way out of this one. You know, and Sulu, Chekhov, good for Chekhov. Chekhov was not horrible in this movie, by the way. Sulu, Chekhov, and Scotty almost don't seem to, you know, they seem also a little insulted that Kirk's asking in the first place, because they haven't even, they've already thought, it took him about 5 seconds to think it over and accept, you know. Whatever Kirk says, they are following Kirk because he's Captain Kirk. And there are all of these moments of, you know, loyalty is so strong that they don't even question it. They break Starfleet. You know, he essentially loses his, Kirk gives up his career to save Spock. Now, I assume it will be addressed how they managed to not immediately be in space jail after this movie.
I don't think there's any doubt that that has to happen.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say either way, but...
Of course. But either way, you know, Kirk, you know, we know that there'll be a way of getting out of it, but Kirk is still risking space.
Well, there's that great line in the movie where he says, you know, I'm going to recommend you all for promotions in whatever,
yeah,
fleet we end up serving in.
You
know, like that. And that's the thing. Like, I think, you know, I think that brings us to an interesting point, because you know, I mentioned earlier that in a lot of ways this is kind of a heist movie and a heist story.
Yeah.
And what I like about it is, you know, it gives much more than Wrath of Khan or the motion picture. It gives all of the characters that we know a chance to shine.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Uhura has her moment.
Oh, my God.
Sulu has his moment. Yeah. Chekhov has his moment. Whoa. Scotty has his moment. McCoy and Kirk, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, part of that, of course, is because Spock is not in the movie and the rest of the characters are given more screen time appropriately. And what I like about it is they're all pulling something off.
Yeah.
But they're not trying to steal something. They're trying to bring something back.
Okay, yeah.
And I like that as an interesting twist on the heist plot.
Yeah, the heist isn't the moral, is the morally correct thing to do.
Well, yeah, let's talk about morality in this movie, because I think that's something that is right under the surface, right? Like, Kirk has always been a character that is more interested in his own sense of morality than doing what is, you know, legally correct, let's say.
Yeah.
And he is completely consistent in that. And I think the rest of the characters in this movie, since they served with him so long, would have some loyalty to him, sure. But I think more importantly, there's an undercurrent of them serving with him for so long and seeing how effective he is at, you know, getting things done in this way, that they're able to go that extra step in basically, I mean, they're committing a capital crime.
Yeah.
They're stealing a Federation starship.
Yeah, that's about as bad as you can get, you know?
I mean, I think the only thing that could have been worse is if they immediately turned around and started firing on Earth, you know, like...
Yeah, the... you know, and then that brings up an interesting point, because they kind of maybe all are of the same, you know, moral alignment then. You know, Kirk does what's right above what's legal. And number one, they're loyal to Kirk because they believe in that morality. And number two, Kirk keeps them around because they believe in the same things he does. He would not trust these people to... he trusts, you know, Sulu, Uhura, Scotty, all the people who help him. He trusts them implicitly. He knows that they're going to do the right thing. In a way, I would say his, you know, look, you can leave at any time, you know... It's a formality in a lot of ways, because I really don't think Kirk thought any of them would actually take the offer. He makes the offer in good faith and, you know, would not be upset at anybody who took it because, you know, again, they need to deal with their sense of right. But he also does know that their sense of right will mesh, and that bringing back Spock, or, you know, at this point, just putting Spock to his eternal rest is their duty.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, let's not forget that at the end of the movie they do pay a heavy price.
Yeah.
You know, they destroy the Enterprise.
Yeah. Now you see, that I did not know happened, and that was the scene that surprised me the most.
Okay, we'll talk about that.
It's the Enterprise is a main character in the same way that Kirk is a main character, and it's a character I never expected to see killed. At the end of the day, I kind of think, you know, just how you think, oh, well, Kirk will always get out of this. You think, you associate Kirk and the Enterprise so well that, you know, you can't think of one being destroyed while the other still lives, really.
Yeah.
I guess so. It was a surprise. It was a major moment, a shocking moment. To see the Enterprise burning is a horrifying sight, because it is such an iconic looking prop. Let's face it. It's one of those ships that everyone knows what it looks like. And
I think that's one of the more affecting and better done scenes in the movie is, you know, where they beam down to the Genesis planet. And they're shot looking at the Enterprise as it's burning up in the atmosphere, and they're just kind of...
Kirk's all, what did I do? And then that, like I said, very quotable movie, you know, McCoy says, you know, you did what you always did. You figured out a way to get us more of a fighting chance, you know? And again, higher than higher than keeping the integrity of the Enterprise is saving Spock. Because Spock is a person, and loyalty to people is more important than loyalty to things.
Yeah, that's true. And I think that's definitely a part of it. But I do wonder if you're overselling it a little bit, because the Enterprise was going to be decommissioned. And I think there is an element of that there as well, where it's kind of that thing where it's like, you know, if you're going to do something bad, you want to be the one to do it, as opposed to having someone else do it for you.
No, that's it. It's he's
giving... And they've lived with the Enterprise for so long, and to be told that they're not going to get to go back out on it, and that it is going to be decommissioned, and oh, by the way, Scotty, go work on this new ship.
Yeah.
And the callousness of the Excelsior's captain, where he just sort of offhandedly comments to Scotty, can't wait to break the Enterprise's speed records tomorrow. And Scotty's like, yeah, what a dick. You know, like, you have no idea what's coming.
Yeah, because at that point, Scotty's probably even finished the sabotage by then.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, he's like going to the transporter at that point. He's getting the hell off the Excelsior. I think it's indicative of, you know, I think that they feel like they've done a job. You know, I think in Star Trek, Wrath of Khan, you know, I think Kirk has this line about, you know, doing their bit for God and country or whatever he said. And I don't know, I might be making that up, but it's in one of the movies. And so I feel like there's a lack of, you know, the pissant little ensign that Uhura shoves in the closet later on.
Sure.
Yeah, like there's a weird undercurrent of disrespect that the characters are also going through in the movie. And well, that's some of it too, where it feels like it's not necessarily that they're destroying the Enterprise or doing any of this because they want more respect, but it's just it they're gonna do what they're gonna do.
They're gonna die taking down as many people as they can.
Like, and
defiant act in some ways.
Yeah, and I think at this point it's kind of like, I can beat up my little brother, but you can't beat up my little brother. And I think there's some element to that as well in the movie.
That might be some of it. And yet, I mean, yes, the movie begins with the Enterprise being decommissioned, but, you know, frankly, when they said that, I thought, okay, well, by the end, they're going to, you know, they are going to have the adventure on the Enterprise, and they're going to figure out a way. And I figured it would end with something like, you know, well, because you did this really good thing, you can get the Enterprise back. Like, I thought there would be some half-assed reason where they would figure out a way of... Kirk has always been clever. If Kirk could figure out a way to get the Enterprise back into commission, he would. And if they wanted him to, they could write in a way for that. I thought I figured that would have happened. So when the Enterprise was actually destroyed, that was actually a little bit surprising. So I want to talk about the Uhura scene, because that is probably my favorite Uhura scene we've ever seen.
The movie is very funny.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And you know, the ensign is saying, you know, he's at the beginning of his career. He's bored with where he is. She's been dealing with this little, you know, this little shit for probably his first few weeks. He's an intern, basically, and he thinks he knows everything. She has seen more danger in her life. She's at the point, all of the Enterprise crew is at the point where danger is boring, probably, you know, and she knows that she's about to go into more danger. She's probably just taking this as a vacation, you know. She explicitly says, you know, I need some peace and quiet for right now or whatever.
She's there because
that's
where they're going to come through and beam onto the Enterprise.
Yeah, no, she's there for a specific reason. And she's probably just, again, she's probably enjoying that. It's a very routine job for the most part, you know, beyond her setting up what she needs to set up and being ready for, you know, when the mission is actually going off. You know, and again, she goes right into Vulcan afterwards. You know, she from there, she's going off into more adventure. She is dealing with the fact that, you know, she's about going to be dealing with the same problems that Kirk is, because she was an accessory to the theft of the starship. That will be figured out very quickly. But I love his line. You know, he says, you know, you're winding down your career, so you can, and you know, she gives him a look, and the look is basically like she wants to be offended because he insulted her age, he insulted her capabilities, he insulted, you know, a lot about her. But she also knows in about 10 minutes she's going to be pointing a gun at him. And, you know, she's she knows she has all the power. She's just not really, you know, she's letting him think.
Well, yeah. I think that's interesting because I think in a lot of ways this movie is the supporting character's movie. And yeah. And they all get a chance to shine and they all get a chance
Don't call me tiny.
Right. To do things that we perhaps have not seen them really, you know, be as active as they have, until maybe since the original series. And what I like about that is, you know, I don't think it's incidental or unimportant that Mr. Adventure, as you call him, says, "Oh my God, Admiral Kirk." He doesn't say, "Oh my God, Sulu," or "Oh my God, Scotty."
Yeah.
Right? There's an implication, I think, throughout the movie that everybody knows who Kirk is. Kirk is legit famous, right? He's done more for Starfleet and the Federation than perhaps any other captain has in the past 20 years.
And especially in the past few weeks, he's fought and finally defeated Khan Noonien Singh. So his picture's all over the papers this week.
Yeah, exactly. But I think that there's an implication there that the rest of the crew are not really well known. And so they get a chance to take advantage of that. Hmm. And really, I think it speaks to there's a weird undercurrent of sort of maybe a little bit of a spy thing going on there or something. And it's interesting because I think it feeds into what maybe the movie is maybe ultimately about, which is underestimating people. And
yeah.
You know, Kruge underestimates Savick. Kruge underestimates, you know, the people down on the Genesis planet. He underestimates Kirk. He underestimates everybody. And ultimately, he is killed at the end of the movie in that hilarious way that he is killed.
Yeah.
And in the same way that everybody in the Federation and Starfleet is underestimating them. You know, the captain of the Excelsior underestimates Scotty. The guard underestimates Sulu. You know, the Starfleet security guy in the bar underestimates McCoy.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, I don't know where you can take that, but I think it's just an interesting...
Well, it's funny because, you know, let's talk about Kirk's been, you know, Admiral means you're promoted upstairs. So, you know, I guess people, you know, and, you know, he tells you, you're winding up your career. These people are old for Starfleet people. They're supposed to be... As far as, you know, I would assume the normal Starfleet career at this point is you're probably doing, you know, maybe some diplomatic missions, you know, some prestige stuff, you know. Kirk, at this point, if he wanted to have a lazy time just going to parades and being applauded, he could very easily do that. Any of them probably could. Probably every single one of them, especially since, you know, they worked for Kirk. Uhura could ask for her position of choice. You know, Scotty could do work on whatever ship he wants to. I mean, I think there is almost an implication that working on the Excelsior is more of an honor than working on the, you know, or is more exciting than working on the Enterprise because it's a totally new technology. You know, who wouldn't want to work on the cutting edge stuff?
Well, Scotty doesn't.
Well, that's the thing. That's none of the people on the Enterprise got complacent. I think there is the understanding that a certain point in your career, you get complacent. Remember the line in Wrath of Khan, you know, get your starship back, otherwise you're really going to grow old.
Yeah.
People are expecting these characters to grow old. They think they are old already. They underestimate them because they feel they are past their prime. And it's a way of saying even... At the, you can't, time does not rob you of your prime, you rob yourself of it. I think that's between the two movies, one of the themes which does begin to appear.
Yeah, yeah.
Meanwhile, the younger portion who thinks they are, you know, the captain of the Excelsior, Mr. Adventure, all of those people seem to think they're, okay, well, we're younger, you know, we have better technology, we're, you know, hipper, we're more... They all think they're really super cool, and they get trumped by experience. They get trumped by people who are cleverer than them. You know, the captain of the Excelsior says, "Oh, well, wait till they go into warp drive." Ha ha ha! Like, and he's super cocky. He's just kind of like, He doesn't even run. When he's woken up, he just kind of saunters to his chair. You know, he doesn't hurry to get out of bed. You know, he.
Well, I don't think it's incidental or an accident that the two captains we see in this movie are kind of incompetent. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, that's obviously supposed to be a commentary on Kirk.
And they have, they have big egos. The captain of the Grissom harps on this captain's discretion so many times.
He looks at the view screen, sees the Klingons, and says, "Oh my God." I mean, come on.
No. I mean, well, let's think about Kirk faced with, you know, there was a life sign on the planet that we are scanning, and that's not supposed to have life signs. Not only would he immediately suggest beaming down, he would beam down himself.
Yeah.
You know, it's, I like that he said, you know, he basically, you know, when they suggest beaming it up, you know, the Grissom captain laughs. He's like, no, that's the stupidest idea I've ever heard, which is that makes a lot of sense. How many, you don't want to beam whatever this is up, fine.
And I think that says something, too, about these characters and the fact that they're seen as sort of out of their prime and maybe out of their time. They are much more of a direct action group of characters than maybe Starfleet, right? Because if you're looking at this in terms of, okay, the Enterprise is over 20 years old, you know, they are, you know, 10, 15, 20 years out from the prime of their career, you know, they have done so much for Starfleet and the Federation. They have explored so much territory. Yeah. They have made first contact with so many new alien races. The Federation is more secure. The Federation is a little bit more mature. Starfleet is certainly. And I think there's perhaps an implication there that Starfleet is much less of a frontier organization and the Federation is much less of a frontier organization at this point. And they don't fit in anymore. And I think that's something else that, you know, is kind of introduced in this movie. And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, I'm always reminded of a great line in Deep Space Nine where, you know, one of the characters says, you know, imagine what it was like in the 23rd century, you know, vast swaths of the galaxy, you know, unexplored, and the Klingons and the Romulans, you know, and the Federation, you know, almost at war all the time. It was a much more violent time. It was a much more, unsettled time. And, you know, if you're looking at this, you know, let's talk about this in terms of 60s versus 80s, because of course this is 1984 at this point. The 60s were a time of optimism. The 60s were a time of sort of unbridled possibilities. And that's what the original series really portrays. And to a lesser extent, I think that's what the animated series portrays. And if you're looking at this movie as a product of its time, you know, we talked about how the motion picture coming at the end of the 70s seemed very drab and very black and white. And I think this movie is right at that time period where we were just coming out of that. And, it's, you know, 1984 was Morning in America, right?
It's kind of a finger to the me decade. I mean, the 80s were about consumption, were about conspicuous consumption, about, you know, you have, you know, the stockbroker, the Wall Street guy becomes the hotshot. That becomes the sexy career at this point in time. You know, the acquisition of wealth, of cool gadgets, of tech becomes very important in the 1980s. And, you know, the 80s are considered in a lot of ways a very shallow decade, a very surfacey decade, a less political decade compared especially to the 60s. And so this is kind of reasserting 1960s values in a 1980s world.
Yeah, yeah.
Saying, no, these things, you know, the world may have changed, but some things did not. And staying true, you know, you need to stay true to these ideals. If you don't... I mean, he explicitly said, you know, if I didn't go on this mission, it would cost me my soul. So, yeah, you lose your soul by not adhering to very strong personal values. So, in a way, this actually is an extremely optimistic and self-reliant. It's a movie which does make self-reliance a big value.
Yeah, yeah. There are some criticisms of this sort of middle portion of the original series movies, which I'll talk a little bit about next week.
Yeah.
Because, of course, next week we're talking about Star Trek IV: The Voyage Home, and that's the third part of this trilogy of movies. You know, this movie ends with them out of uniform. Spock is back, but he's not back.
Yeah.
And the Enterprise is destroyed. They're in a bird of prey. What's going to happen?
Yeah.
So find out next week.
Okay. Well, what are we rating this movie?
Oh, right.
I would give this movie 7 weird dog Muppets.
I think this is a flawed movie, but it's certainly an interesting movie. I would give it 6.
Okay.
So join us next week for Star Trek IV.
The whale one.
The Voyage Home.